So today we're reading from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Leela, chapter 8, texts 50 to 55. So we'll just read the translations for the first few verses. I wish to hear from you about Lord Krishna. Indeed, my mind is inclined to desire this. Therefore, I wish to see you again. This is Lord Chaitanya speaking to Ramananda Roy after they have just met. Ramananda Roy replied, My Lord, although you have come to correct me, a fallen soul, my mind is not yet purified simply by seeing you. Please stay for 5 or 7 days and kindly cleanse my polluted mind. After that much time, my mind will certainly be pure. Although neither could tolerate separation from the other, Ramananda Roy nonetheless offered his obeisances to Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and departed. Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu then went to the house of the Brahmana who had invited him and took his lunch there. When the evening of that day arrived, both Ramananda Roy and the Lord were eager to meet each other again. And we come to today's verse. Translation by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. After finishing his evening bath, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu sat down and waited for Ramananda Roy to come. Then Ramananda Roy, accompanied by one servant, came to meet him. Purport. A Vaishnav who is supposed to be advanced in spiritual understanding, be he a householder or a sannyasi, must bathe 3 times a day, morning, noon, and evening. When one is engaged in the service of the deity, he must especially follow the principles of the Padma Purana and take regular baths. He should also, after bathing, decorate his body with the 12 tilaks. End of purport. Srila Prabhupada ki. Om Jnanati Mirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Jaina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Ma Om Vishnupanaya Vishnupanaya. So a very short purport, but one with a lot of import, describing the basic fundamental activities of a devotee's life, the lifestyle of a devotee. And so we all know, we're all familiar with wearing the correct dress, bathing, and wearing tilak. So here Prabhupada says something interesting, that whatever you are, a householder or a sannyasi, you should bathe 3 times a day, morning, noon, and evening. Now in other places, other details have been given. But really the idea is that as one becomes more advanced and becomes more and more situated in Krishna consciousness as a complete lifestyle, the more one accepts this mood, this activity of bathing as being very, very important. So we all know the standard phrase, cleanliness is next to godliness. So Prabhupada liked that phrase, he accepted it. And in one place he said, cleanliness is godliness. So keeping ourselves clean is very important. Now in today's world where everything is very, very gross, everything is always to do with the physical body, the physical substances, the physical environment, people's idea of cleanliness means literally dealing with keeping the body clean, scrubbing, exfoliating, moisturizing, whatever's involved in the modern ritual that so many people do. So that's on the very physical level, the aspects of the gross body alone. And therefore we have made many contraptions as well to help us deal with the gross body. Power showers, with pulse setting, with all sorts of other gadgets and features, digital temperature control, which will deliver you the perfect shower at any moment, at the perfect temperature and pressure according to your whims. So lots of arrangements are being made for physical cleanliness. But there's a dimension to cleanliness which isn't always apparent when we speak about bathing. Now in this culture, in this setting, when these great saints would take a bath, it would be a dip in a sacred river. The Ganga, or Narmada, or wherever the saints happen to be near the Yamuna, or even a clear lake, a clear kund. There are so many kunds dotted around all over India where different pastimes took place. We of course know Radha Kund, Shama Kund, the very famous kunds. And there's also Bhishma Kund. There are kunds everywhere, Bharat Kund. If you travel to different holy places, Ayodhya, Naimisharanya, there's a kund everywhere where something important happened. And the saintly persons, the renunciates, or the advanced devotees, they would take bath as a regular activity. Of course, the physical cleanliness is one aspect of it. Clearly, when you wash yourself with water, you're physically clean. And that has a dimension of reducing disease and ill health as well. That's understood and accepted by everyone. But there's another dimension, and that is the bathing of the subtle body. So that is an aspect which is often overlooked. And actually, one of the purposes of bathing is to clean the mind, to cleanse the mind, to cleanse the consciousness. So therefore, a bath in a clean, clear lake or river is very much desirable. Typically, such bodies of water are not hot. They are cool. They are cool, even cold. And especially in winter, very, very cold. If you happen to be one of the rishis living up near the Himalayas, Gangotri, or maybe not that far even, Haridwar, Rishikesh, somewhere like that, you'll know just how cold the water is. And yet the advanced devotees would not hesitate to take a bath in such water even under those conditions and temperatures. The idea being that when one bathes in that sacred place, there is a special cleanliness that comes from the potency of that place, the potency of Mother Ganga, the potency of Yamuna Devi. So that is one dimension, that one actually gets some sustenance, some nourishment through that. And the other is that one's consciousness is awakened with a little bit of austerity. A little bit of austerity often causes us to snap out of the sort of comfort, the gentle lull of comfort that we're often in. It's a luxury or enjoyment tends to create in our minds a sort of a mood of relaxation, enjoyment, happiness. And it's not wrong to be happy, but what it does is it actually stops the mind operating with clarity and engaging with determination in spiritual practice. And this is one reason why it is described that this particular realm, this sort of bhumi area, this area within the planetary systems, which is neither heavenly planets nor hellish planets, gives us a kind of an average or a good mix of both pain and pleasure that simultaneously dissuades us from wanting to go any further down to the hellish planets, but also doesn't offer us the level of luxury that is available in the heavenly planets. Why? Because that's a distraction. When one is conditioned by a sense of happiness and enjoyment, they tend to be very happy with that situation and therefore do not make much endeavor to progress beyond it. And therefore it is described that if one is in the heavenly planets as a Gandharva or a Kinnara or something like that, there is so much enjoyment, so much happiness. One tends to be very, very blasé about the prospect of undergoing austerity to come close to the Supreme Lord. And there have been many examples of problems in this regard. Narad Muni was a Gandharva. And due to this complacency, mood of enjoyment, he was basically singing kind of cinema songs, Hollywood, Bollywood, in the company of sages, when he should have been chanting the glories of the Lord. It was a mood of conducive enjoyment, which you can see causes one to forget oneself. The same thing happened also to King Huhu later on in the Bhagavatam. He then becomes cursed to be a crocodile and participates in that pastime with Gajendra. Same thing, he was also a Gandharva. And he decided to go a step further and decided to pull the leg of one rishi who was bathing in the water, just as a joke, just for fun. And normally you wouldn't expect such behavior. But this is what happens, that when one gets too comfortable, too happy, too opulent, too satisfied, where there are no needs, no wants, no concerns, one starts to misbehave, becomes mischievous. And so this was, in one sense, Prabhupada described this as part of the hippie phenomenon, whereby many of those who became hippies in that era, 1950s, 60s, 70s, they were actually born into wealthy families, many of them. And they were very well to do. They had, society was open to them. You know, they could move around, they could do whatever they wanted. But actually that sort of situation of opulence and luxury kind of fostered a feeling of rebellion within them. And then that was fed and nurtured by so many other influences and factors. The idea is that that opportunity to, advance, having Suchinam, Srimatam, Gehe, or whatever it was that they had, that privilege in that life, was put aside in favor of real low-grade behavior. So then, principles broken, free love, the whole 60s scene was kind of available. And so it's a sign that in our lives we sometimes struggle and strive to obtain something, which, as the Bhagavatam says, becomes our ticket to hell. So opulence for many is the ticket to hell. It directly uses those words, that one works all their life trying to acquire more and more money. And the consequence of that is that one becomes conditioned to sense enjoyment. And when one is conditioned to sense enjoyment, one must commit sinful acts. It's not that one might, it's that one must. Nunam pramatta kurute vikarma yad indriya pritaya apranoti. When one becomes very much attracted to sense gratification, becomes addicted to such things, then one automatically performs sinful activities. Because the wholesome sense gratification becomes, it just becomes boring. Wholesome activities that you could do in sense gratification, when you have a large fund with which you could do so much more, you very slowly, gradually step into that realm. And that's the danger. It shouldn't happen like that. It doesn't have to happen like that. It's not a rule that it happens. But typically, when one is engaged in sense gratification, it will happen. The only way to avoid it is for a devotee to realize that whatever they have, whatever dimensions are currently operating in their life, whatever facility they have, this is all ultimately the grace of the Supreme Lord. And it is only by His grace that we acquire such things, and it is only by His grace that we can maintain them and not experience the dreadful potential effects of them. It is not wealth, beauty, opulence, strength, fame, any of the qualities that the Lord has, that when we have them are directly to blame. It is just that they cause us to develop pride, to increase our level of contentment with our own greatness. That's the danger. But we all have that propensity, and people are often trying to obtain some greatness recognition for themselves through manipulating themselves through different positions, ranks, hierarchies, fame. They try all sorts of things to rise up the ranks, get more of this, more of that. It's a propensity that's within the conditioned nature. And that is partly the problem. That the desire to just improve materially actually is a distracting factor. So when one bathes, it's a bit of a shock to get you out of that comfort zone. That's one simple kind of physical effect that happens. It gives you a little bit of a bit of an awakening. Okay, this is cold, this is bracing, a little bit uncomfortable, but it's purifying. And then one feels actually clean and pure. It does, in a subtle level, cleanse the mind as well. That is part of that process, that it It cleanses the mind of the propensity to be contemplating dirty activities or objects. And so therefore it is advised that cool baths are the best, especially in the morning. A quick cool shower is the ideal thing for a devotee to do. It's healthy, it's also refreshing. And so this is part of Vedic culture. Now, Vedic culture doesn't mean you do this only in summer, when it's nice and warm, when it's comfortable. Actually, the austerity comes when one practices this in different conditions. Now, we should also remember that different people have a different ability to practice austerity. This is also a factor. We're speaking about general principles which are advised for devotees or practitioners to follow. But each person, even within that practice, will have a different capability. Some people can, you know, withstand a good 5-minute dose of icy cold water without much problem. Yes, they'll feel miserable. But other persons, you know, 1 minute and their entire body temperature is kind of gone and they're about to fall over. So one has to be practical and sensible. Our bodies in Kali Yuga are not that strong. That's why certain activities which were recommended in the past are not really emphasized so much for us. Sannyas is one of those things that is actually technically forbidden in Kali Yuga. The sannyas of the Bhagavatam, as it's described in the 7th canto and hinted in 5th canto and other places, is a lifestyle of great austerity, which involves great regulation of your entire activities. It includes not doing anything at all to make yourself socially compatible. So there will be very strange practices that were followed, walking around like a madman, being dumb, even growing one's hair, acting in a way that no one in society will come near you. That's the Vedic sannyas, and undergoing severe austerities. And even if you read the descriptions that were recommended for vanaprasthas in the 7th canto, that is quite a description as well. I don't think anyone could follow that in today's day and age. Why? Because our bodies are simply too weak, and our minds are too weak also. So we know as Kali Yuga progresses, our faculties will decrease, our bodies will become weaker, and we will be always disturbed. Yupadrita, as the verse says. Always, prayan alpayusha sabya kalavas min yuge jana manda sumanda matayo manda bhagya yupadrita. We're always disturbed. We have low faculties, low mentality, low intelligence, low lifespans, alpa ayusha. We don't live very long without a whole host of medical assistance. Lotions, potions, tablets. Some people are living off tablets. We know that. Different illnesses, diseases. So the statistic that this person lived to 80 or 85 or 90, lifespan is increasing, isn't really a reflection on the natural state of things. The lifespan of that person would potentially be much less without these things. So it's an artificial system, an artificial arrangement. Now we're not talking about from the perspective of the jiva, because the lifespan of a particular jiva in a body is set. We're talking about bodies specifically. Different bodies that people would inhabit would not normally lend themselves to such long life. And so this is the problem. So when we read these descriptions, we understand the concepts, we should also understand the principle behind them and use them as an inspiration for us to improve ourselves, rather than to look at others and say, you're not doing this, you had a warm shower yesterday, you know, this. It's not really the purpose of it. We have to be kind of sensible and practical, but realize that there are spiritual standards. And so in spiritual lives, we will often get through Shastra, we will get a dose of a very strong, rigid principle or a strong detail given to us. And so different people of different mentalities work with that in different ways. Some of them take that very strong statement, one must bathe 3 times a day, and they follow that fanatically. That becomes one of the key things in their life, to follow this detail that they particularly like. Others look at it and say, oh, I can't be bothered with this, this is too much, this is just something for the fanatics. You know, it's optional. I mean, after all, Worshipping the Lord is more important than bathing. There are so many verses to that effect. And so they go the other extreme and take it very casually. Well, spiritual life means actually we should be trying to follow the highest standard at all times, but not to get caught up on it. Not to have an OCD type of approach to any detail of spiritual life that actually causes us to forget the entire principle. These are things that support spiritual life. They're not the goal in themselves. To be clean, to have good consciousness is a supporting principle in spiritual life. But if with your good, clean consciousness and healthy body, you spend all day thinking about how to increase your sense gratification, that's not a successful use of that facility. That becomes just another means, it's another description of you in your particular mode that you operate. The principle of sense gratification still remains. But a devotee who accepts all these principles and tries to follow them as much as possible in order to increase the quality of their service, for such a person, they are getting the real benefit and the purport of such instructions. Now, we of course know that Krishna is the supreme purifying factor in everything. And all the externals are a component of that. You know, we often chant, Om apavitra pavitro va sarvam stam gadopi va yes maret pundarikakshasa paya apayantara suchihi Shri Vishnu, Shri Vishnu, Shri Vishnu. But when one remembers the lotus-eyed Pundarikaksha, the Supreme Lord, one becomes cleansed internally and externally, both inside and outside. That is the power of the Supreme Lord. Sometimes we may have the facility to engage in bathing, austerity, keeping ourselves very clean. And sometimes the facility may not be available. Might simply not be possible. Well, there's no loss, really. Because Krishna wants us to make a success of this life, so he supplies us multiple paths to assist us. And if we're going to be successful, we have to accept that Krishna is actually the supreme purifying agent in all aspects of our spiritual life. That includes our sadhana, our service, any of the 9 processes, our deity worship, our smaranam, sevanam, archanam, whatever it is, samadhi, all the different stages that we, different activities that we do. Krishna is the supreme agent. So even when we participate in the different realms of varanashram, Atha pumbir dvija shreshta varanashrama vibhagasa swanushtitasya dharmasya samsiddhir ritoshanam. That whichever ashram we're in, whichever varana we're in, the highest success of life comes when we understand that our occupation and activities are supposed to be samsiddhir ritoshanam, for the pleasure of the Supreme Lord. So we do the activities, we follow the requirements. Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda ki. We follow the requirements, and according to our varna, ashram, situation, social status, ability, whatever, the prescriptions are different. Here Prabhupada is giving a general rule regarding bathing, 3 times a day for everyone. But in other places, there are different regulations given. Brahmachari is supposed to bathe once a day. Grihastha twice a day. Sannyasis and vanaprasthas, 3 times a day. It is meant to be increasing austerity according to the ashram and the responsibility and the path that is chosen. In the Bhagavatam, when different individuals, Diti and others, engage in vows, Pumsavana ritual, etc., bathing 3 times a day is a requirement for those, even though that might not be their normal practice. It is described Devahuti, after she married Kardama Muni, adopted that lifestyle, which was a change from her normal life as a princess. And so she started to bathe 3 times a day. And she became very austere as a result. And so when one is situating themselves increasingly in spiritual, in full spiritual absorption, then they start to adopt a higher and a higher standard of renunciation, austerity. which keeps one pure and clean. And that's the idea, that it helps us with our cleanliness. Now, there's one other dimension mentioned here, and that is the tilak marks. So we all wear tilak. We wear our Vaishnav tilak, which is typically we use Gopi Chandan, which comes from a place in Dwarka. And Gopi Tala, that place, that's the mud that we typically use. That gives this nice golden chandan that we have. But really, there's no such restriction in terms of what one can use for tilak. The sand, the soil from a very holy place itself can be used as tilak. Radha Kund tilak is potent. Some devotees wear that. Now, we're not advised to wear red tilak or anything like that. These are items of passion. They don't have the correct mood and the correct effect. We should not wear any dirty items either, any tilak from a contaminated place. But tilak from any reasonable place, we try and get the purest item that we can, and we use that. And there's another dimension to that, which is not just about wearing whatever you want on your head, which is from a holy place. Prabhupada has explained that this tilak is part of a uniform for us. It's part of a uniform. The soldier has a uniform. It wears its, whichever country you happen to be in, it'll wear its colors, and the soldier will have its stars, stripes, and whatever, all the different endorsements and the helmets and insignia of that place. So this is our tradition also. So therefore we, as much as possible, we follow our tradition. And there are different sampradayas, and within those sampradayas there are different traditions. And that's accepted. That's accepted. But for us to be kind of picking and choosing which sampradayas traditions we adopt is not really advisable. It's a kind of a speculation that we are applying to the process. So certainly in ISKCON, as followers of Prabhupada, we should be wearing the type of tilak that Prabhupada wore as an official item as well. So whilst wearing Radha Kund tilak is okay, it's not a problem, it's a very auspicious substance, it's definitely not the way we should be presenting ourselves when we go in public. It's not the way that we demonstrate our strength of practice in Krishna consciousness. As an item, as a substance, it's, you know, it's beyond compare, it's superb. And if you go to Radha Kund, definitely, to put some Radha Kund tilak on your head is great. But it should not become our uniform. And so this is another sort of subtlety that sometimes people develop polarized opinions around. Some say, oh, you people are so rigid, you only do this, this, this. Well, rigidity, strict loyalty, chastity to the specific line set down by our link of the parampara is a requirement for a disciple. The disciple is supposed to hear the words, the messages of their spiritual master. And not just the words, the instructions, but they're also supposed to imbibe the mood of their spiritual master. This is a component which is not always visible. The mood and the agenda, you could say, the spirit, the desire of the spiritual master, their specific flavor of practice, of Krishna conscious practice, is what the disciple is supposed to be adopting. It's not the spiritual master gives you an endorsement to then go and do whatever you want. So some people have a confused notion about this. They say sometimes people are too strict, too austere, that you only do this, you only eat in this way, you only do this, you only wear this type of dress. You could say that, but actually the reality is that we are following a higher principle than just doing something rigidly with attachment. We are following in a very chaste manner the example set down by Srila Prabhupada. So there are so many dimensions to this. We can speak about the dress. These are largely external things, but external things which our acharyas have given importance to. They gave them importance. Not that ISKCON made it up, as is often directed. ISKCON didn't make it up that we wear dhoti, that we wear kurta, that we wear tilak, that we should be clean shaven. That's Mahaprabhu's mission, clean shaven. This is not something made up by ISKCON. This is the standard set by Lord Chaitanya, followed by members of the parampara, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada, who gave direct instructions on that matter to those who consider themselves to be His representatives. Now, we do not apply the standards that we apply to ourselves to everyone else in the world. That's not at all our point. And we certainly don't look down on anyone who may be following something slightly differently. That's also a big mistake that sometimes we make when we become very very accepting of a particular direction. We tend to look down on others with our rigid codes. No, we should understand that these instructions are for me. They're for myself. They're for anyone who wishes to be a representative of Prabhupada in true spirit. When you act as an employee of a company, or when you act as a representative or a spokesperson, the standards expected of you are different to the standards expected of a normal person who participates in your organization. Right? If you're a customer in an organization, you don't have to wear any uniform. You can walk into the Apple store or wherever and wearing whatever you want. Maybe masks might be compulsory at some point. Not anymore. But that could be just about the only restriction you have on you. But if you're an employee there, then you're expected to behave and dress in a certain way. So some people belittle this. And so we have to be aware of the dangers of kind of adopting liberality, which is not sanctioned in scripture, is not endorsed by the behavior of the acharyas. When one does that, it's that path of conditioned happiness. It's that path of, okay, I am now sufficiently advanced that I can start deciding what the details are, the new details for my particular place. And if one happens to be not of a very, very exalted caliber, doing so is very dangerous. Only highly exalted acharyas have the authority to modify principles and practice, to tailor them for specific circumstances. So when we have acharyas like Prabhupada, they can do that. They can make certain adjustments because their adhikar, their potency is unparalleled. When other people who themselves are barely advanced followers of such persons attempt to do that, it becomes a distraction. It becomes, as the Gita says, it becomes a disturbance. Ye shastra vidimutsrija vartate kama karata na sasiddhim avapnoti na sukham na param gatim. So when a person disregards scriptural injunctions and acts whimsically, they achieve neither success nor the supreme destination. And their activities become a disturbance. They tend to disturb. Who do they disturb? Well, they disturb the new people who come to the movement. The old ones, yes, they don't care. When someone else is doing a deviation, well, that's just the norm. For anyone surviving in Krishna consciousness for a number of years, seeing numerous deviations is just the norm. And you stay by not surrendering to those deviations. But for someone new who comes, who doesn't really understand the scene, just coming into the temple is a bewildering experience normally. You come, the smell, the sights, the noise, the sound, the way people speak, the food obviously blows everyone's minds when they have it, the prasadam. But it's an overwhelming experience anyway. And so people do not have the criteria or the discrimination at that time to know what is correct and what's not correct. That's all part of Krishna's process, that ultimately, you know, one comes with their best intentions, their best endeavors. And if their mood is sincere, then Krishna will direct them somehow towards other persons who are also sincere. And they will learn the practices, the traditions correctly, accurately, parampara, in correct following. But if someone has a kind of a mood of potentially exploiting the situation for their own advancement, to maybe they're thinking, this is a nice environment. And wouldn't it be wonderful if I managed to maneuver myself up the ranks of this place and I'd have a whole load of devotees who are humble and submissive. I mean, and I can do all sorts of wonderful things. That's very dangerous. And the society needs to make sure that such people with such mentality are not given any kind of promotion or facility. That's one of the duties of leaders, to not allow someone's charisma and false ego to be permitted to be accepted as a basis for authority. No, one's purity and one's humility, one's actual following of the principles should be that criteria. We are supposed to develop humility. We're supposed to be surrendered. We're supposed to be the friends of all others. We're supposed to be well-wishing agents for all other devotees, new and old. But if someone comes with the mood of attempting to exploit that mentality of others, then that's not something that's supposed to be tolerated. Because it is simply a material thing. It's simply a materialistic propensity. And different people have that propensity. But hopefully, in time, with maturity, these things fall away. So here are two points which are mentioned by Prabhupada. An emphasis on bathing and an emphasis on tilak, marking the body appropriately. So that we fulfill all these functions. We support our spiritual progress. We support the mission of our founder Acharya, of our spiritual master. We act with loyalty to them. We act as empowered representatives of them, because empowerment doesn't come from our own charisma or education or study or any of that. Empowerment comes when the seniors bestow their mercy. In the initial discussion between Suta Goswami and Shonaka Rishi in the Bhagavatam, when they're just about to start, it's described that your spiritual masters have bestowed upon you all the facilities endowed upon a gentle disciple. That is your qualification to speak. Not your great learning, your wisdom, your study, all of that. They have endowed you, empowered you, because they see that you have submissively and humbly followed their path and pleased them. And so we can do these things just even on that basis alone. Because these are quite mild items, right? To bathe and to wear tilak. No, most people wouldn't have any real disagreement with them. But there may be other things later on in the scripture, some other details which are more challenging to us. Ways to behave, ways to speak, ways to conduct ourselves, respect we should show to maybe persons in higher orders. Maybe these details will come and we don't like them. We think, oh, this goes against my nature. But actually, even if we just follow it out of a spirit of loyalty to the spiritual master, that itself will be tremendously empowering for us. So this is a very interesting discussion between Ramananda Roy and Lord Chaitanya. And of course, it took place on the recommendation of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, who asked Lord Chaitanya to speak to Ramananda Roy. And so this is the beginning of that discussion. And over the next few verses, they will talk about Krishna. And there'll be a wonderful discussion coming up about externals of Krishna consciousness. External principles of Krishna consciousness versus the real essence of Krishna consciousness. So a devotee doesn't reject anything. They don't reject the internal essence. Pundarikaksha sa bhaya bhayantara suchi. They do not reject that Krishna is the supreme all-purifying agent. And they also do not reject some potential externals, like varnashram, bathing, cleanliness, decorating the body, wearing the right dress. So these are lessons that will come in the next few passages as that conversation proceeds. Now I want to stop there. Does anyone have any questions on that? Because today is also the appearance of Lord Varadev. So I wanted to just say a few words about Lord Varadev. But if there are any questions on anything I've said so far, yes, Ian Prabhu? There's the mic.
Hare Krishna Prabhu, thank you so much. It's very amazing how you presented the class today and these points. I had a question in regards to the first quarter of your class. You know, you mentioned how when individuals are trying to embrace Vaishnav culture, then we pick up some of these things.
Mm.
My question is in regards to nurture. For some of us, like myself, we're trying to still pick up some of these things, or this, like the Krishna conscious lifestyle per se.
Mm.
Or maybe we're coming from a background where our lifestyle was slightly somewhat different and required a few different kinds of things. And so we've been in one way conditioned in that way. So my question is, not only for ourselves who are aspiring as devotees, but in our preaching endeavors, how should we be encouraging individuals to embrace this culture? Should there still be some level of laxity to what they've been used to some particular extent? Or should we immediately just dive them fully deep into the deep end and let them waddle their way through and kind of figure it out? What's your suggestion?
this is the contrast, right? As I mentioned, we have the extremes. Either is it one or is it the other? No, there's a progression even by which we came to Krishna consciousness. And it wasn't with all the rules and regulations, the dress, everything at the beginning. It wasn't. It was someone slowly, carefully nurturing us from our infant steps, from our just weaning ourselves off the diet of the material world and just slowly giving us something to come to Krishna. So we should have great compassion, great tolerance for especially anyone we're attempting to help elevate. Ultimately, we have to realize that we can't elevate anyone also. That's a fact, that any shakti there is that may be taking place in an interaction between myself and someone is Krishna shakti. He will give it to us when he's happy with us. So now there's a difference between the standards you follow and the standards that you might expect of someone who's a new person or even, advancing. So with us also, yes, we've come from different backgrounds and different levels of practice. And for some, it's more degraded than others. Some people don't bathe. It's their normal, it's their normal state. Some people bathe fanatically. That's also their conditioning in this life. And sometimes what happens is, it's not just that you start off from that level and then you become a devotee, then it's smooth sailing. What happens is sometimes after that point, you snap back. You can snap back to your previous level. And sometimes you can even adopt levels and behavior which you never did before even. If some particularly strong dose of the material energy hits you, or if you commit an offense of some kind, and then you get knocked. You get knocked for six, as it were. And your practices may also descend to quite a low level. The thing that should be done then is to climb up again. Climb up slowly, steadily. Realize, actually, this was the stage I was at once. You could be like Ajamil, very highly qualified, very competent practitioner, but then became very, very degraded, extremely degraded, committed so many sinful acts. But there was a path for him to come back up again. Worst thing is when you descend to a low level and you think you are still okay. And you think that you are still a fine devotee in order to instruct others. That's the danger. The danger is that you consider, okay, I've undergone a problem here. And with Krishna's grace, with spiritual master's grace, I need to come back up again. Problem is when you think, I don't have a problem. And therefore then you can propagate a whole spectrum of deviations, thinking they're completely okay. And depending on your level of charisma and your ability to impose your will on others, you may even have a large following in that regard. Now, having a large following, being able to convince people on the basis of your charisma or eloquence or whatever, is a complete non-starter as far as spiritual strength is concerned. Yes, we see this is the norm, this is the way the material world works. Bhishmadev said this actually. During that episode when Draupadi was being disrobed. And none of the Mahajans were able, Dronacharya, Bhishmadev, none of them wanted to speak anything. One of the points made there, I believe, by Bhishmadev was that when a weak person speaks, his words may be disregarded. But when someone who is strong speaks, even if they speak nonsense, those words might be taken with respect. That's a trait of normal life. That's a trait of just normal standard life. But it's not a useful principle to adopt in spiritual life. So ultimately, one's purity does win. You know, you could have an entire group of followers who are now following a deviant, and that group could be increasing, and it could be expanding. That does not give it any more legitimacy. There's no more legitimacy whether you have one person following your devious ideas, or 100 people, or even the entire committee in whichever body you happen to be in. It gives no more legitimacy to your behavior. So these are kind of dimensions of it, that different stages are there, and we can also move through the stages. Even once we've committed to spiritual life, and once we've maybe had some experience in spiritual life, the ever-present danger is that we will start to compromise in some area or other. And so we should be very careful at that time and engage more strongly in the rules, the regulations, the requirements, the advice to lift ourselves out again. So it's an element. Hopefully some component of the answer.
Yeah, definitely. I appreciate that. And just a follow-up to that, from that question, just based on, and I know we have lack of time, but just based on that as well, you see that when, let's say, devotees struggle to kind of meet that particular standard or, you know, meet a particular, or, you know, like what is required, they somewhat distance themselves from, like, the rest of the devotees, or, you know, in a bit of shame, because there is a subtle pressure to kind of fulfill a particular external presentation in one sense. So what can we do as devotees to kind of create a safe space for individuals who even, let's say, struggle to enable them to be uplifted? Yeah.
Yes, it's a big task for everyone to help people who are in that position. A little bit of struggle is good also. For some time, if a person keeps a little distance, it's a period for them to settle down. It's a period for them to kind of contemplate the reality of the situation. Ideally, it's best that someone else is looking out for us. That's always nice, if someone is looking out for us. The spiritual master, some advanced person has us on their radar. And they might make some attempt to help us. And ultimately, we will advance once we start following the practice again, once we start taking association. But a little bit of time where we kind of contemplate whatever it is, and maybe step outside, maybe modify certain things, that's good, actually. Because sometimes we just tend to lurch from one activity to another without any regret. And regret is not very fashionable these days. But it's also useful for a time, for a period of time. It's not useful when it leads to complete dysfunction in a person's life. But it is useful for a period of time, because all the persons who made mistakes, the Bhagavatam is full of them, people who made mistakes, they expressed great regret, great dissatisfaction as to their behavior. So that's also a stage that everyone has to go through. And then when Krishna sees, just like when he brings us to the movement, that is like another episode to come again into the movement. Now Krishna sees, okay, this person has now sincerely decided to do something about it, to rectify themselves. Now I'll connect them up again. I'll bring him to this person, to that person, to this sangha, to this book, this, that. I'll give him this lecture which he needs to listen to. And that's amazing, you know. You can just listen to something and it'll be just what you need. So Krishna is looking out for you. And Krishna never loses, never lets go of someone. In that sense, might be for this lifetime if a person's very naughty, but but again, in the future, Krishna's got an eye out again, and he will try to help that person. Thank you. Okay, so was there anything else? Yes, Prabhu. And to wait for the mic.
You mentioned that subtle body is also getting clean when you take a bath. If you take a bath not in the holy river or in holy kund, what exactly cleans the subtle body daily life?
Ah, well, it's the potency of the water itself. If it's Mother Ganga, this empowerment there, Yamuna Devi, you know, when you're bathing in their waters, depending on our consciousness, it has a big effect. If we consider, you know, when we're bathing in the Ganga, that this is pure liquid prema. And that is a fact. Lord Chaitanya bathed in those nectarian waters, understanding that they were touched by the lotus feet of Krishna during his pastimes. They are nothing other than pure liquid prema. If we have that consciousness, then as we're bathing there in that water, you can just imagine our subtle bodies being completely cleansed. That itself is a rectification of our intelligence, rectification of our mind. Subtle body is the mind, intelligence, and ego. Immediately, the ego is suppressed because we realize that there are superior powers here. This is the dust of the lotus feet of Krishna. It's nothing to do with my greatness. It's his dust that I'm swimming in. And the mind is pacified, it's peaceful. The intelligence is purified when it considers these concepts. That this is the potency of the Lord. And then there are so many other dimensions as well. So the pacification of the intelligence can happen through an understanding of the holy places themselves. One bathes one's intellect in the study of the Gita, as one of the quotes is on the Gita, right? As one of the quotes written on the Gita, I bathe myself. That's what happens. When one recalls the pastimes of the Lord that happened in those waters, that's very nice also. As I said, all these different kunds. When you invoke that person in your consciousness, that immediately cleanses. It occupies our intelligence because you meditate on it. And that's purifying, pundarikaksha, purifying. So it acts on all three components of the subtle body in different ways. And the gross body, of course, the other way is if it's cold, it gives you a shock. That can wake you up sometimes. That's good for the mind. We're supposed to, Bhakti Vinod Thakur said, who said we should beat our mind with a, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, beat our mind with shoes and a broomstick in the morning and evening. So, mind is a rascal. So if you can freeze it a little bit, you know, some freezing cold treatment, or if you can just ignore it, that's the best thing for the mind. Just ignore it. Just see it as an alien occupying us. I mean, actually, this is factually correct, because in the Gita it says that the mind, intelligence, and the senses are sitting places for lust. Lust has infected these three parts of the body. It's like a virus. It's attacked the body in these three places. So these three things are not functioning correctly: the mind, intelligence, and the senses. And of course, the ego is there. You know, it's there enjoying its new identity, its new faulty identity. So, yes, anything that shocks, cajoles, nourishes each of these three components out of their misbehavior is very beneficial. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so Lord Varahadev is a very interesting incarnation. Now, we won't tell the whole story of Varahadev and how he lifted Mother Earth. That is what he's famous for. He's the boar incarnation. Very unconventional form to take. But for me, I always found this very refreshing. Because God doesn't only appear as a human, in human form. He appears in all sorts of other forms as well. He appears as an animal, as a boar, as a fish. He appears as a lion, half man. He appears in so many forms. He comes as a dwarf. He doesn't just come as a fine, good-looking king like King Prithu or someone, you know, Lord Ramachandra, broad shoulders, you know, all the usual descriptions. He comes as a little dwarf brahmachari. It's impressive. Now, it's said that the Lord's descriptions that are given in the Bhagavatam and in other places, they're only a small portion of what the Lord does. It said, avatara hi asankhyaya, that the avatars of the Lord, the qualities, the forms that the Lord takes, they are unlimited, like unlimited rivulets flowing from a river. You can't really count them, there's tons of them, streams all over the place. The Lord's incarnations are just as vast And they cover every single species also we hear. The Lord appears in every single species. Cat, dog, potentially. No, they're not described in the Bhagavatam, but yes, why not? And so that's refreshing, because for me, it tells me that every single living entity in this world is connected to Krishna, and Krishna cares about them. Every single one. Every single one, not just certain ones. And even if one is born into a certain body, which gives them difficulty in different ways, you know, imagine being an elephant. Okay, you think nice and big, but it's a bit troublesome because you have a very dull brain in comparison. Prabhupada says the intelligence of an elephant is disproportionately low compared to the size of its body. So you have that. Taking birth as a cow or a bull is not recommended either. I mean, we'll think the cow or the bull, they're nice, they give milk, they're exalted animals. But it's not a birth that's recommended because you don't have the ability to consciously engage in devotional service. At best, what could happen is that someone else uses you and engages you in devotional service, which is good if you're lucky. And if you're not, well, you'll be one of the statistics. Daily slaughter, 110,000 per day in America. They publish these statistics every day. You could be that. It's not a great opportunity or a great choice to have in life. And so, yes, the Lord appears. He appears as a boar. And the boar has a quality of rummaging through dirty places. And so when the Lord appeared as this boar, as the personified Vedas, he had a specific job to lift Mother Earth out of the Garbhodak ocean where she had fallen. And fallen into a dirty place, basically. And so the boar arrived with his tusks. The boar has very nice tusks. And just like a forklift, I like this forklift analogy, just like a forklift, he lifted Mother Earth and placed her back in her orbit. And he was just suitable for that purpose. And of course, then he had a whole adventure with another demon, Hiranyaksha. And this is one great fight that takes place between the Lord and this demon. And we won't talk about the fight, but we'll say something about Lord Varadev, his appearance. Now, first of all, he appears in this very unusual form, the form of a boar. Very unusual. But the way he appears is also interesting. Lord Brahma is there contemplating, wondering what to do about the fact that the earth is in this degraded condition. And while he's contemplating, while he's in his meditation, this tiny little thing comes out of his nostril. Now, most things that come out of people's nostrils are not that auspicious. But this little thing came out of Brahma's nostril. And Brahma's thinking, what's going on here? This doesn't normally happen to me. And came out situated in a minute form, minute boar form. Then within a few moments, that expanded. It was now the size of a calf and a cow and then an elephant. And it just kept growing until there was this gigantic boar just situated in space. Now the boar, through this highly unconventional appearance, gives another little detail to us. Because the breath of Lord Vishnu is the Vedas. When Lord Vishnu breathes, the Vedas manifest. And it is said also when Lord Brahma breathes, he acts as the carrier of the breath of Vishnu. When Lord Brahma breathes, he's carrying the breath of Vishnu, which manifests as the Gayatri Mantra, in one sense, the Gayatri Mantra, but also the form of the Lord, as the personified Vedas. So Varahadev is described as being the personified Vedas, the transcendental sound vibration. And it's a transcendental form and which brings us the ability and capability to exit this world. Because the Vedas are the key for us to exit this world. And what is that verse? It said, Maya Mugdha Jivera Nahi Swata Krishna Gyan Jivera Kripaya Koila Krishna Veda Puran. That the living entity on his own, a conditioned by Maya, has no chance of uncovering his own normal real spiritual awareness. You're so in such a dull state that you can never just figure out that I'm a servant of Krishna. It won't just pop into your head automatically. But just to give his mercy to all the living entities, Krishna has manifested the Vedas and the Puranas. Maya Mukta Jivera Nahi Swata Krishna Gyan Jivera Kripaila Koilo Krishna Veda Puran. He manifested the Vedas and the Puranas just to help all of us. We've fallen into this Garbhodak ocean. We've fallen into this ocean of nescience. And Lord Varahadev, as a personified Vedas, is here to lift us out. So when we take, even this analogy is so perfect, when you take the assistance offered by the Vedas, the Vedic scripture, the Vedic literature, we can actually be rescued from this troublesome condition of drowning. And so Lord Varahadev is one of these unconventional forms, but his mission is the same as all the others. Great mercy, great care for the living entities, a desire to do something good for them. So when we contemplate him, we contemplate janma karma jame divyam. Krishna says we contemplate his appearance, unconventional, his activities, unconventional. When you read about his fight with Hiranyaksha, you'll realize it's unconventional. One attains Krishna consciousness. One doesn't have to take birth again and again. So that's what's possible. So through all our bathing, through all our tilak, through all our dress, our meditation on the Shastra, we have a chance to purify and lift ourselves out. Is that okay? Any questions? I'll make one announcement. At 11 o'clock today, His Grace Kripa Mahaprabhu will be initiating two devotees in the Haveli. So if you are able, then please go and give them your blessings. It's a very important stage, as you know, from our discussion today, to have the mercy of a spiritual master. So please go, give them your blessings and participate. Thank you. Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita ki, Srila Prabhupada ki. Hare Krishna.